Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode 111. The test of a work of art is, in the end, our affection for it, not our ability to explain why it's good. Stanley Kubrick.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, my indie film hustlers, to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Enigma Elements. As filmmakers, we're always looking for ways to level up production value of our projects and speed up our workflow. This is why I created Enigma Elements, your one-stop shop for film grains, color grading LUTs, vintage analog textures like VHS and CRT images, smoke, fog textures, DaVinci Resolve presets, and much more. After working as an editor, colorist, post, and VFX supervisor for almost 30 years, I know what film creatives need to level up their projects. Check out EnigmaElements.com. And use the coupon code IFH10 to get 10% off your order. I'll be adding new elements all the time. Again, that's Enigma, E-N-I-G-M-A, elements.com.
Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. So guys, today on the show, I'm really excited to have this guest on the show, Sean Baker, the director of the Sundance darling Tangerine. The man has shot a movie on an iPhone, and that was a big event. He made more noise than I think the winner did at that year, Sundance, which was 2015, and his ability to make a movie look amazing, great story, very energetic. If you guys haven't seen Tangerine, you've got to watch it. And he shot it all on an iPhone, and it was remarkable to watch. And I really dug in deep on how he was able to do it, what he did, all the technical stuff, as well as, like, you know, did he have permits on the shoot, all that kind of stuff, and the story behind the movie, and what happened to him after Sundance, and so on. And it was really an exciting interview to have with Sean. And I wanted to bring him on the show so I can show you guys that, look, it's all about the story. It doesn't really matter if you have the latest Red or the latest Alexa or whatever the next big, you know, 15K camera is. It's about a story. And it's about using the camera that is properly going to be used to tell that story. And he chose the iPhone. You know, that wasn't a no-budget movie. It wasn't like he just ran out with $5,000 and made a movie. Had a budget, but he decided to shoot with the iPhone because it was the right tool for the right story at that time. And the next movie he's shooting right now, which we'll talk about, is being shot on 35mm. So that's something that, as filmmakers, we have to understand. We have to choose the right medium and the right camera or in the right format for the kind of stories we're trying to tell, like Darren Aronofsky did with Black Swan and The Wrestler, which he shot on Super 16mm, and how Christopher Nolan shoots IMAX on a lot of his movies because that's the format that he likes to use for his storytelling. So I wanted to bring him on the show to really kind of show you guys what's capable of being done. And Sean is amazing. He gives a lot of great, great knowledge bombs in this episode. So sit back and enjoy my conversation with Sean Baker. I am very grateful for our next guest. I'd like to introduce Sean Baker to the show. Thank you so much for jumping on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks. First of all, man, I'm a huge fan of Tangerine and Greg the Bunny. But we'll get to both of those later. But okay. First of all, I know a lot of people like to say that you were an overnight success, which is wonderful to say. But you've been actually doing the hustle for about 15 years, if my math is correct, right?
No, it's a little longer, actually.
Really? Almost 2 decades?
It's more like, I don't want to give away exactly how old I am, but it's over 20 years, actually. It's easily over 20 years because I actually shot my first feature, Four Letter Words, in 96, which is 20 years.
And what did you shoot on when you shot that movie?
We shot that on 35 millimeter.
What is this? What is this 35 millimeter you speak of?
Yeah, right. Which is such a that it almost makes me cringe. I know you're totally joking.
I completely
still,
yeah. But there is somebody out there listening who's like, "What is this 35 he speaks of? Is this a new camera?"
I know.
It's so scary.
It is. It was weird because at the time I had purchased the short ends off of 12 Monkeys, the Terry Gilliam film.
Oh, how cool.
And that must have been like 2 years prior to that, like 94, I think.
They were sitting on a refrigerator for 2 years.
Yes, yes. But, or my parents' freezer or something. But they were all, it was totally good. We never had one problem. And 2 years later, we shot the film. It took me a while. Post-production is always a problem for me. Always a problem for me. Okay. It's post-production either it leads me into some sort of spiral, whether mental, physical, whatever. But basically, that took me over 4 years to figure out the proper way of cutting that film. But I was in my 20s, and time is definitely a different thing in your 20s. It goes by way too fast, and you don't even realize it.
It's a blur.
And it was during those 4 years, actually, that Greg the Bunny was established and discovered and sort of fell into my lap. So that was happening at the same time. So, but anyway, I know I just rambled, but it's been over 20 years. Yeah. And that overnight success thing is, I think it's such an incredible rarity. If that really is ever really does happen to somebody, I think there's even Tarantino had a film before Reservoir Dogs, nobody's an overnight success.
I think the only guy that I can say that was an overnight success was Robert Rodriguez. Because he literally just busted out with El Mariachi, and before then he was doing short films on VHS at home. So I think he literally was almost an overnight success. He was 23.
Right,
can you imagine that, man? 23 and have that kind of pressure and attention and the whole town chasing you. I mean, how he's survived is beyond me.
Right. No, it's very inspirational. It just shows that, it's that hardworking, proactive mentality that's important and it's what leads to, I think, ultimately exposure. It just, even if you have to just keep on knocking on that door of the industry for 20 years, eventually they listen.
And that's what I preach at Indie Film Hustle all the time. Like, guys, it's not a short game here, man. This is a long game.
No. it's literally last man standing. It really is.
You're right.
It's crazy. And so your lifestyle and your quality of living can suck for 25, 30 years until you finally, and a lot of my friends who I went to, high school with are almost retiring, if not already retired. And I feel like my career is just beginning while they have made enough money over the years in banking or whatever to retire.
Right.
It's really crazy.
Yeah, right. No, it's a brutal – we're scaring the hell out of everybody listening right now.
Yeah.
So how did you get into the business, and why did you want to get into the business in the first place?
Oh, it's all the way back to first grade. Quite honestly, I was, I was one of those kids. I was going to be a fireman or, construction worker. And the next day, my my mother brought me to the local library where they were showing, I think, from what I remember. Now, of course, it was first grade, so I'm not sure whether I'm just making some of this up or whether the memory is really there. But I think they were showing 16 millimeter short scenes from the Universal monster films.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I remember sitting through the scene in which the mummy rises and gets stabbed. There was the, you know, Dracula rising for the first time. And then there was, of course, Frankenstein, the burning mill sequence at the end of James Whale's Frankenstein. And that just stuck with me. It just seared right onto my, you know, prefrontal cortex. I was just like prefrontal lobe. I was like, right. Oh my God, that image of just the of Boris Karloff looking through looking through that spinning mechanism of the mill. I just remember going home that night and saying, I want to be a filmmaker. And so my parents were, you know, they had the Super 8 equipment around because of family movies, home movies. Then a few years later, VHS kicked in, and I was like one of those kids, like what you mentioned earlier with
Robert
Rodriguez, like making tons of those, like a real, like, and they were, most of them were ripoffs, you know, they were just remakes.
That's what you do when you're starting out. You literally copy completely, but then eventually you find your voice.
Right. But there was like, you know, Space Wars instead of Star Wars. And I think some of them we didn't even like retitle them. We just did Red Dawn. Okay, we're going to make our own Red Dawn, which is an incredible, like,
I would love to see that. You should actually post that somewhere, Sean. Seriously, that must be amazing.
It's a time capsule because it shows the way that kids growing up in the 80s, how nuclear war and how the threat of, you know, a war with Russia at the time was actually a real thing and how it was actually in our nightmares. And that was something that it's so today watching it is such a completely it's mind blowing to see little 13-year-olds going, you know, commie scum. You know, it's really amazing. It's amazing. But anyway, so throughout junior high and high school, I did a lot of that. I was living out in New Jersey. My parents live out in New Jersey, so I actually got to go to like film courses at School of Visual Arts during my high school years, and then I got into NYU, Tisch, and I spent the 4 years there. Making some decent films, 16 millimeter. I was proud of a few of them. I actually didn't make a senior film because I was still sort of editing my junior film. Instead of making a senior film, I actually produced somebody else's senior film. And, but during that whole time, I was just sort of, I think I was being very much influenced by a whole new way of, you know, the European and indie cinema, because I did not know much about it going to NYU. Of course, I knew the biggies. I actually was even a projectionist and a theater manager in a small little cinema that's now closed in New Jersey. And during the days they showed Disney films, and at night they showed whatever the new foreign film was, you know? Right. And so, you know, I got a little taste of that stuff, but it wasn't truly, I don't think it was a focus until I was at NYU and I discovered, you know, the French New Wave, really the French. I mean, of course I knew about the French New Wave, but I had seen the classics, but I never really diving into Eric Rohmer and really discovering that stuff. And that opened up the world to and then you had place. I don't know where are you based?
I'm in LA.
You're in LA. Okay. Mm-hmm. In New York, and LA is so great right now in terms of, different cinemas retrospectives. Oh, it's so great. It's wonderful.
I just saw Lawrence of Arabia in 70 mil the other day.
Oh, where?
I forgot the damn name of that theater, but it was down the street, and they were showing like Vertigo the next week. I was like, oh, I couldn't make it. But they're like, do that stuff all the time here. I'm from Miami originally, so there was nothing like that down there, really. And here, like every week, there's something new, like a whole Brian De Palma retrospective, and you know, like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And thank God. And now you have all of these, you know, archivists who are, you know, and all these Blu-ray labels who are making sure that, you know, the original negatives are being restored and rescanned at 4K. It's great. It's a great time for, you know, making sure that, you know, you can see all these old classics in the proper way. But anyway, so in New York was wonderful as well. And it still is. It's changed a lot. But at the time that I was at NYU, you had like, you know, Kim's Video was like the big thing, mm-hmm. where you could see almost anything you mm-hmm. wanted to see. And then there were, of course, all these retrospective houses, and there was a Cinema Village and Bleecker Street Cinema, and which was at the very end of its run when I came to NYU, but it was still there. And you still had 42nd Street if you wanted to take advantage
of
that. The last year or two of the Deuce. And then there was Anthology Film Archives, and that's where I got to see like Rocco and His Brothers on 35mm. So that was really like, okay, I'm going to pay attention now to the Italian neorealism. That brought me back to, you know, to Sica. And then I think that by the time I graduated, I was really, and Richard Linklater was out there and sure. Soderbergh. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to make one of these small personal films. And I happened to be lucky enough to land a job at a small publishing house right out of NYU, mm-hmm. and that allowed me to cut my teeth on some of their industrials, and one or two happened to be like a nice commercial, like a slick commercial. Mm-hmm. So I was able to put money aside, and that's what allowed me to buy that raw stock for Four Letter Words, and then mm-hmm. That happened, and so yeah, that's really the way that it
started up.
That's.
Now you talk about Greg the Bunny. That was such a fun show, man. How did that come to be? How did that come to being?
Well, so it was during that time where it was Dan Milano, Spencer Shenoy, and I were just basically waiting for things to happen. You know, it was a few years after NYU, and we didn't know exactly. I had this film that I didn't know how to cut. You know, I wrote it in a nonlinear style. It was supposed mm-hmm. to be sort of like a Rashomon mm-hmm. sort of mystery train thing mm-hmm. going on. But mm-hmm. what happened was that it wasn't working. So it was taking me all these years to figure that out. And then we were all doing our odd jobs and our temp work. And I remember one night, it just happened to be that there was this – Dan Milano had a little puppet sitting around his apartment in the East Village, and I think it came from like a short film that he – that Chris Bragosh mm-hmm. actually was who I co-wrote Tangerine with and Starlet with. He was the one who actually – he's like the fourth unofficial member of Greg the Bunny, because he's actually the one who found the bunny puppet back in the day. Mm-hmm. And so Dan Milano picks this thing up and starts riffing on it with it. And I have this VHS camera, and I just pick up this VHS camera, and we just start documenting him. And he just starts improvising like you wouldn't believe. And we realized, you know, we already knew Dan was like this comic genius, but mm-hmm. to see him make a voice, you know, create this voice, yeah. and just start riffing, we were in awe. And we thought, why don't we put something up on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, which was public access here in Manhattan. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, we did. This is pre-YouTube, you know.
Yeah, of course,
this is the way you got exposed back mm-hmm. then, you got exposure. And next thing you know, William Morris was actually watching this stuff at the time. They would watch public access.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, that's how they look for fresh talent, you know, going to film festivals and watching public access, I guess.
Back in the day.
Yeah. So next thing you know, somehow through through Gil Holland, who is a independent film producer who, you know, you look him up. He's done a ton of he's helped bring a ton of movies together over the years. Mm-hmm. He actually was the one who I think connected us with IFC, mm-hmm. the actual channel.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
The IFC channel. And they asked us to do these Greg the Bunny interstitials, which were basically just us making fun of independent film. I mean, we were parodying independent film. So we're able to do like 5 to 10 minute little parodies. We did a, you know, David Lynch parody. We did a blue, what is it?
Blue Velvet?
Everything you can imagine. I mean, we had even The Godfather somehow wound up on there, even though that wasn't really an independent. But, you know, we parodied these movies, and then that just started rolling, you know. A few years later, you had Neil Moritz and bringing it to Hollywood, and we had 1 year in which it was on Fox. Right. And the year that it was on Fox was both our best and worst year. And best because it got us our fan base, and we were able to, you know, we had Seth Green on the show, Sarah Silverman, Eugene Levy. And it was like the year that just basically said, okay, at least the public knows we exist. I feel as if it was creatively terrible. I mean, you know, it wasn't our vision. But it gave us the opportunity to then continue after Fox. We went back to IFC, this time with even longer parodies, with bigger budgets. And we did that for a nice 2-year run in like 05, 06. Mm-hmm. And then after that, and then 2010, and Shout Factory actually put out a DVD of both seasons. Mm-hmm. And then MTV gave us a spinoff in 2010, I guess it was. Wow, 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that was a spinoff with the other character by the name of Warren the Ape. Mm-hmm. So basically, we had like this thing that kept me afloat and kept us afloat over the years. It was a great way of having fun, practicing with improvisation, comic improvisation, which is something that because I learned how to do that, I think, how to work with my actors that way, mm-hmm. with Greg the Bunny, it led to the way I work with all of my actors today in these features. Mm-hmm. And it was a way of, you know, paying rent in which we didn't have to get a 9-to-5. It was a it was a way of just, you know, we weren't getting rich, but it was basically just keeping us afloat, keeping us fresh, and also just allowing us to experiment and to hone our craft, you know.
I mean, seriously, that's the filmmaker's dream right there. Like, you're able to do what you love. Sure, you're not living the entourage dream, as I like to call it, but you're making a living. And you're making a living doing what you love to do. You get to play. You get to experiment. I mean, Fincher did it in his way with commercials. So did Bay and all those, and Spike Jones and those guys. And that's how they made a living. But if you can find a way to make a living creatively, my God, that's like the dream.
Yeah.
And then something will pop.
Exactly. And I feel as if, you know, there were, you know, of course there were those years where I had to resort to, you know, doing between seasons, and I would go and do, you know, industrial type stuff. I would edit. But I always tried to keep in the industry somehow. I didn't want to like just go off and do something completely outside, not even related to film and TV at all. I always tried to stay, even if I was editing other people's stuff or shooting stuff. I always tried to stay within the industry just so that I felt like I was keeping my practice up, you know,
keeping your skills sharp.
Right.
So how did Tangerine come to light, man? How did you get the idea for Tangerine?
Well, so really quickly, I'll just do this in 30 seconds. After Greg the Bunny came about, I still said, I want to make cinema. I co-directed this film called Takeout with Xiching Zhou, which was a tiny little standard definition, almost like a Dogma 95-ish film here. And it was – and Kino Lorber put it out. And it was like a real neorealist little slice of life about a undocumented Chinese worker in Manhattan. That led to me saying, I like this realm I'm working in. I like – even there, you know, there's humor still in here, but I'm talking about serious issues here, and I think that that's where I want to go. That led to Prince of Broadway. Prince of Broadway got me a little more got me some festival circuit recognition. We got to travel the world with that film. That got released eventually. Lee Daniels helped us get it out there by presenting it, you know, doing a special presentation thing. So now I had Takeout and I had Prince of Broadway. And I think what really helped me there is that those two films got nominated for Spirit Awards and they sort of competed against one another.
In the same year?
And yes.
That's
which
awesome.
Which is what it looked – it made it look to the outside that it was like a 1-2 punch thing, but it actually wasn't. Takeout was made – a couple of years before. It just took forever for it to get exposure. So, so to, you know, it was released the same year as Prince of Broadway. And I think that that together got me, those two films together got me attention. And then at that point, thank God, you know, Ted Hope came on board and helped me find financing for Starlet. And Starlet got, you know, did its whole – got released through Music Box, did its – you know, got its nominations and everything like that. And that actually is what led me – well, no, that was a weird period of time there because I thought that Starlet was going to open all the doors I needed to have opened, you know. And I was in a place where I was like, oh, no, I don't know what's going to happen here because I couldn't find the money for a bigger budgeted film. And Mark and Jay Duplass were – told me, hey, if you ever want to make a micro-budget film with us, we love Prince of Broadway, and if you can do give us like a Prince of Broadway, we would be more than happy to finance it and to find you know to co-finance it. And I said, oh, I don't want to do another micro-budget. These are too hard. They're they suck the life out of you, and they're really just. I thought I made too many. I've already made three. Why do I have to make any more? Or I already made four at that point. Why do I have to make more? But life just
works out that way.
dictated that I have to make another one. You know, so we went. I remember calling Mark and I'm saying I said something like I guess I'm ready to make another one. I can't believe the budget's going to be like less than like a third of what I did Starlet for, but okay, here we go. And he was like, okay, what's your idea? And I said, the corner of Santa Monica and Highland. And he was like, oh yeah, excellent. All right. Yeah, there you go. Let's do it. And I said, okay, but now I have to start the whole immersion process because with all of these films, I do a lot of time. I spend a lot of time in the environment that I'm shooting because I feel it's the only right, the only way to do it. So there's that whole immersion thing I have to do, and that takes months. So Chris and I had to go and just start like literally pounding the pavement and going up to people and asking them what they know about the area and et cetera, et cetera. And eventually we found Maya Taylor and Katana Kiki Rodriguez. Kiki was introduced to us by Maya. And it was after – it was just spending time with the both of them and their friends and hearing a ton of different stories. And finally, there was a story that Kiki told us that was semi-based on a real experience in which, you know, which is the main plot line of Tangerine, in which a, you know, a transgender sex worker finds out that her boyfriend has been cheating on her and she's off to find this cisgender woman who is part of the affair. And that was really what just stuck with us in terms of, wow, that is dynamic. And it's also has a lot to say and there's so much to read into there. So let's do that. And that's really how it came about. As we got closer and closer to production and realized that it, unless we truly asked people to work for free completely, I would not be able to shoot on anything, you know, any high-end camera. So I can maybe shoot on one of the DSLRs, but everybody was doing that at the time. I wanted it to look different. And then as we got closer and closer and I realized, wow, if the iPhone has now gotten to the point where it has totally acceptable video quality.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And with the with a few other tools involved, I can really elevate this to a cinematic level. And then that's really where it went. It was like, okay, and then it'll help us also with working with all these first-time actors and some of the non-professionals and people off the street. Mm-hmm. They won't be intimidated by an iPhone. So I remember it was really – that was one of the deciding factors. And I called up Mark and we started talking about this, and Mark was very supportive of it. He was like – yeah, man, do it. Let's do this. And we shot some tests so that we knew it would look good. And Technicolor actually gave us a wonderful favor and allowed us to put it on their big screen over there. So, and when we saw that it was holding up on the big screen, we all were excited and said, yeah, let's move forward with this. And I remember going to Sundance that year thinking we were going to be one of many.
On an iPhone.
Yes.
All right.
And it wasn't. We were like the only one, which was really strange to me. So I'm not saying we were the first film to be shot on an iPhone, but but that year at Sundance, we were the only film on the iPhone. And I think that really just that first screening in the what is it? The Eccles Library.
That's a big ass theater. It's insanely how big that thing is.
We weren't even in that one because we were in the next section. We weren't in main comp.
Oh, you weren't in main competition.
No, we were in next.
So, okay. So then, but you won Sundance, didn't you?
No,
you didn't win Sundance. I thought you won Sundance.
No,
you just made the most noise.
We made noise. I guess we made noise.
Yeah. Oh.
But I mean, the next section. Looking back now at that year, I'm so happy we were in the next section because,
explain the next section real quick. Explain the next section.
It's just another. I guess it's just like a section. The way that Cannes has their main comp, but then has all these other sidebars in a way. I guess it's just considered, you know, a side category that focuses. I guess the way that somebody can look it up, but basically I think that the way Sundance describes it is that they're focusing on, like, I don't know, innovation and
up and coming.
The future of film. You know, Locarno has that section too. They call it the filmmakers of the future or something. So a lot of the festivals have these sections. And this was a year in which James White was in competition. I think what else was in next? Next was really strong that year. So I was really, you know, honored to be a part of that section. And
you had never been in Sundance before?
No. We it was weird because we were on their radar. I think what happened was that Starlet was given to them too early. And that's a lesson. By the way, you asked me to think about, like, lessons learned. That's a big lesson. It's extreme. I learned that early on, actually. You really, really have to make sure your film is 100% presentable when you're presenting it for the first time to anybody, to anybody. I think that I unfortunately gave them Starlet at like almost a 2-hour cut. And it was just like, it was like, this is way too long. And, you know, they didn't know whether or not, whether or not this film would be good or not. They had no idea. So you know, but they did, at least I think I kept on their radar. And then of course, Mark and Jay helped out tremendously.
you think?
yeah. I mean, you know, they're just their names on the film alone helped get the thing, you know, exposure. No,
sure. Of course,
yeah.
Of course.
And then Magnolia, they were the most excited about it at Sundance. Uh-huh. And I love Magnolia. Uh-huh. You know, they yeah, put awesome. Out wonderful films. They put out my two favorite films from the previous year, Force Majeure. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's not one of my favorite films, but I definitely respect it. Did I just say necromantic? Oh, yeah. My God. Nymphomaniac.
Yes,
I'm sorry. Nymphomaniac.
Yes, Lars.
And I'm, Lars von Trier is one of my favorite directors of all time. Yes. So the very fact that I'm on the same from my film is being put out by the same distributor as his stuff meant everything in the world. So we were very excited about Magnolia, and they said that they would give us a theatrical run, which was very important to me, because with all of my films, except for my first, I've had a theatrical run, and I want this to continue. You know, even though I know we're really getting close to cinema in the theaters dying, I feel as if there's still, yeah, exactly.
Magic. So, there's definitely magic there. Now, can you explain a little bit about the tech that you used when shooting Tangerine?
It's not complicated in any way, shape, or form. It was literally the iPhone 5S at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Shooting 1080 with an app called Filmic Pro, which is a great app. Now it's advanced along with the phone, so you can shoot 4K, you know, log on your new 7 if you want. But at the time, we were shooting 5S with Filmic Pro. They had this wonderful feature. They have this wonderful feature on there in which you can actually change the compression quality. So you can up the quality of the compression. So it's actually it looks better than the video you would normally get from just, you know, going into camera mode on your phone. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so there's that app that we used. Mm-hmm. Then we used an anamorphic adapter, not a lens, because you have to use the iPhone lens when you're using an iPhone, but it's an adapter that fits over the lens and allowed us to shoot in true scope. Mm-hmm. So we were shooting 2.35. We stretched it out in post. Filmic Pro allowed us to shoot at 24 frames a second. We colored it I cut on Final Cut. And then we colored in Resolve. So basically, it was a very simple process. It wasn't as, you know, quote unquote, pimped out as everybody likes to think it was. It was very, very simple.
Yeah, no, I actually did some research on how you did it, because I was very curious when I saw the movie. I'm a colorist. I've been a colorist for over 20 years as well. And, you know, I was really curious when I saw it. I was like, wow, it looks really good. And it's a very unique look. It's not something that you would get from other digital formats. So I was really curious on how you did it. So I did a lot of research on how you put the whole thing together. And everyone thinks it's like, oh, it was like, you know, you spent, you know, $5,000 pimping. I'm like, no. It was a few things, like you just said.
Yes.
But I also – and I love – and this is one thing a lot of filmmakers – since we talked to a lot of filmmakers, they're like, oh, you know, the Tangerine was just shot on an iPhone. I'm like, yes, Tangerine was just shot on an iPhone. But that was his fifth movie, and he knew what he was doing, you know. And it's not like a bunch of guys just grabbed the phone and they just got out of film school and like, hey, let's go make a movie. It took, you know, you have to know what you're doing. And, you know, it's not like you just grab the phone, like you said, an adapter, the proper app, things like that. So that's the thing that doesn't get explained a lot. And people just say iPhone, Sundance, feature, and that's all they hear. But there is a lot of there's a lot of other stuff that you did to get what you got.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just I guess that I just wanted to make the film look as good as it could look, as unique as possible. Mm-hmm. And shooting those tests really allowed us to find a look, you know. And and also, you're shooting in Los Angeles. Los Angeles has a certain look. It really does. No matter what anyone says, every place has its own look, and it almost dictates a style. And Los Angeles dictated this orange style on us. It just simply did because of the – we were shooting a lot of Magic Hour stuff. We were shooting towards – so we took advantage of that low winter sun. That low winter sun is enhanced by the pollution in the air that gives us this beautiful, these beautiful orange sunsets. And so we just kept shooting that stuff thinking that it would – okay, cool. Are we overdoing it? No, not really. And so, you know, just kept moving forward with that, and it gave us this tangerine look, and it's part of the reason that we actually settled on the name, on the title Tangerine.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And now how many people are on your crew?
Oh, it was tiny, and it was really just like my really close team. You had Darren Dean, Xiqing Zhou.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Both of whom, you know, I've worked with before.
And they were
Crisper Gosh.
And they were, and what were they? What were they? The
part? Well, you had those two doing production. They were both producers, Darren. But then Xiqing was also costume design and continuity, and she was also acting in it. She also was the woman behind the counter at Donut Time. And so she had to do continuity while acting. Pretty insane. Then you had Chris Bergosh, who was the co-screenwriter, but he is, he's the type of writer who is present on set all the time. I mean, we were rewriting stuff as we were shooting. So it was important to have him there, and to and he was also doing, you know, we all had to be our – we all had to be production assistants. You know, we all had to like go and get meals, you know, when – you know. And then you had Iron Strauss, who was specifically sound. And then Radium Chung and I shot it. And that was literally it. I mean, I don't – I'm trying to rack my brain. The actors, of course, were always helpful. You know, you had Karan Karagulian, who played Razmik, coming in and helping us. We had – you had – PJ Ransone, or James Ransone. And you had, of course, the girls, Maya, Kiki, and helping us out in terms of navigating through their neighborhood and their world. So that was really it. I mean, like, and Mark and Jay were incredibly hands-off in terms of produce, executive producers. Marcus and Carrie Cox, who also put money into it, were extremely hands-off.
That's awesome.
It was it was really it was this sort of it was almost when you're in that mode of like almost desperation where you're like this one has to get recognized. You're in this weird bubble of just you're just like it almost goes back to it felt like making some of those VHS films in high school. You know, we were just making it up as we were going along, and just not making it up in terms of the story, but just like trying to figure this thing out is with the very little money that we had. Part of the just really quickly, part of the style actually just came from the energy of that area. I mean, you can look at my other work and you can see it's much slower and much you know, it's not as hyperactive. And this film was, I think, part of it was iPhone and part of it was the energy of the area. It was just telling me to move the camera more and more. And so I had my little my 10 speed. I don't know if it's a 10 speed, but I had my bicycle on set, and that was sort of the dolly. So I'd be on my bike with my left hand on my handlebar and my right hand holding the little stabilizer, which I forgot to mention, by the way. That was the other tool. It was like it was the Tiffin smoothie made by Steadicam. Or made by Tiffin. And basically it was this little — this was before there was the internal stabilizer in the iPhone. So it was you needed this in order to shoot on the 5S. And it actually looked really good, and it allowed me to get a lot of different angles and get on my bike and, you know, just go do 360s around my actors and be very free with the camera. So that's really how it happened.
Now, I know you just recently moved out back to the East Coast, right?
Only to do post-production on my new film. We're here in New York. We're taking advantage of the tax incentive here for post, and my girlfriend Samantha Kwan is actually in a play, Viet Gone, which is part of the Manhattan Theater Club. So it's because we both need to be here at the same time.
So I didn't know if you knew or not that Donut Time is closed.
I did. I always thought, you know what? It's so very upset to hear about that.
Yeah, I drove by the other day. I was like, whoa, no.
I actually was trying to get the signs, but we could not contact the owners. And then on top of that, if I had all the money in the world, I would definitely make that my production office.
That would be the
awesome thing. I know.
Wow. Can you imagine that being like,
yeah.
Because people who don't know that corner, like I've driven that corner a million times. And like they don't, the energy on that corner is pretty insane.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like it's with Prince of Broadway, I caught the end of an era. Mm-hmm. When the film is about the West African hustlers who sell counterfeit goods in the wholesale district. Well, mm-hmm. the wholesale district is really now like the Ace Hotel mm-hmm. and like all this gentrified section of the city. Mm-hmm. They've all moved down to Chinatown. I caught the very last bit of that era. It mm-hmm. looks like I did the same thing happened with Tangerine because that area has completely changed. You have, you know, your Donut Time has closed. You have, you know, galleries moving in there. It's mm-hmm. It's very different than it used to be. I mean, for three decades, it was almost like an unofficial red light district,
right.
which was not only focused on, you know, transgender sex workers, but also, you know, gay hustlers and cross dressers. And it was, and that lasted all the way up to maybe like 2 years ago. And
right.
then, yeah.
And that was it. Now, this is a question I've been dying to ask you. Did you have any shooting permits or did you just guerrilla the whole thing?
No, we did. Actually, we did.
Okay.
We had permitted for different corners and we tried the blanket permit up and down Santa Monica.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we permitted it when we were shooting in the interiors mm-hmm. of locations. We always had permission. The only thing that we stole was the bus and the subway.
Okay, because it was just too expensive to get the permits.
Yeah, we didn't have insurance would not handle that. So we I guess with these few years later, we can admit it that we stole that stuff. Yeah.
Don't be ashamed. It's okay.
But I also always want to emphasize that, you know, it's, I can, as an independent filmmaker, there's a responsibility I have to tell other filmmakers, you really have to do what's safe though. It's about safety.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially, so, that's why I was dying to ask you because you're like, it's one thing to kind of like shoot inside someone's house that's really controlled and, you know, you know, not to get a permit maybe. But like
right.
on the street, on that corner, or anywhere within a 2 mile radius of that area, I was wondering. I'm like, did they really just run and gun it, or did they actually do it?
Yeah,
right?
It was a combination. I mean, you know, we didn't let people know we were shooting, so therefore you had a lot of people in which we would have to chase them down after the fact and get their releases because that's required in the United States.
Of course,
it's not required. It's not required in other countries or some other countries. You know that, right? I mean, you can go to Taiwan, you can go to Korea and you can shoot on the city street and not have to get anybody's permission because it's a public space. That's the way it should be. But, you know, we have a very litigious, you know, society and we're all looking to cash, you know, it's just ridiculous to me.
Yeah,
it's absolutely ridiculous.
Unless you're a documentary, then that kind of opens it up a little.
Right. But then, of course, then there we've reached the point where we're blurring the line.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I like to say that I make hybrid films, which, mm-hmm. you know, blurs the line between narrative and docu. So where do you then – how do you then say, well, this day I'm shooting in a docu style, so therefore I think I should be allowed to get away with certain things. And you know what I mean? I just faced this with my new film in which there was this constant – it was a union film.
Mm-hmm.
And which changes everything, by the way.
Yeah,
but
I was gonna say,
when
yeah.
but But when you're shooting and then you see somebody on the street and you're like, that person looks amazing. I wonder whether that person is a character, and you start talking to that person. And if that person like is interesting enough, you're like, oh, wow, I should just improvise a scene right now with this guy or this girl. And then you do it. But if you're doing it like under SAG rules or under union rules, you have to Taft-Hartley that person. You have to suddenly pay before you even turn the camera on. And if you agree that you're going to be shooting that person and that person's going to speak, you have to give that person whatever the day rate is, which is like $900. Mm-hmm. That would be an impossible way to make the films I've made up to this point. Like you simply can't do that. You have to, you know, there should be another way of working in which people can, you know, you almost can test the waters and then agree whether or not if that person makes it into the final cut.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Then that you Taft-Hartley that person. That's the way it should be. There has to be a way. Now that we've actually moved into a place where we are making these hybrid films, we have to figure out new ways of, you know, of making them, like the legality of making them and the logistics of making them. That has to change. Mm-hmm. It really does, because it was incredibly frustrating on my last film. Where I was suddenly felt as if I wasn't able to do what I've done before. And the whole reason I'm making this film and have the opportunity to make this film is because of the films I've made before. Mm-hmm. So suddenly I'm in a place where I'm like, hey, thanks for giving me so much more money. But I can't give you the same product because we are now,
you've handcuffed me.
You know,
you've handcuffed me. Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. Yeah. I mean, I just finished doing my first feature. And
Congrats.
Oh, thanks, brother. I appreciate it. And I tell you, you know, we kind of run and gunned it.
you
had to. Yeah. There's no way. Like, you know, when you're at a bigger level and you have bigger budgets, yeah, I'm all about it, man. But when you're just hustling from the street level up, literally with Tangerine from the street level up, you know, you kind of just have to have some sort of freedom. And I know the unions are starting to work a little bit more with indie filmmakers because so many of them are just leaving. They're just like, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to go elsewhere to make my movies. And all that runaway production's happening, especially here in LA. But it's just, there has to be a balance, man. Like, you can't expect
– There has to be.
You can't expect guys like you and me to have to pay the same thing that Avengers does.
Right.
You know, it's just –
that's true.
It just doesn't make any sense. But no, which brings up a good point. Did you do any improv in Tangerine, or was it all scripted?
Oh no, there's a ton of improv. There always is. With everything I do, I ask for improv takes. So there will be some scenes will be very tightly scripted, but even if they are, by the second or third take, I'm saying, hey, why don't you put it into your own words? You know what I mean? Like, don't memorize this stuff. As long as we are getting the point across and we're hitting the beats, that's all that matters. It's like if we get from point A to point B, that's all that really matters. And so yes, there was improvisation.
How much of it made it the final cut in your opinion, percentage wise? That was improv versus scripted?
Oh God, it's really hard to say, but maybe like, see, it's hard to say because after a while I was intentionally telling them, don't learn this line. But basically what you're saying is that you have to, you know, you're mad at this person because of this reason, you know, so it's giving them the general sense. I have to say though that Kiki and Maya, they delivered some of my favorite. Well, and the entire cast, Mickey O'Hagan, who played, you know, Dinah in the film, they have each one of them has a diamond. You know, each one of them has gold in some of their improv. Kiki, one of her lines was, she comes from the hills. She's a hillbilly. You know, that was her. Maya Taylor saying, you know me so well, don't you? That was an improvised line. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or you see right through me, don't you? Mm-hmm. That line is so important because, you know, critics have picked up on that. And the trans community actually has picked up on that line as it being a very important line for the film, because it's for once, the exchange is being seen through the eyes of the sex worker instead of the customer. And so therefore it's a line like that I just have to say thank you so much to my actors for, because they brought something to the table that elevated the entire film. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? The mm-hmm. entire experience. So that's why I love improv, and it all goes back to Greg the Bunny. You know, it all goes back to Dan Milano being such a freaking genius, and me being like, how do we capture this genius? You know, how do we work? And so over the years, I've figured out a way of working with my actors where I'm basically part of the conversation. I just cut myself out, you know? So you'll sometimes, like in Starlet, where, they're all on the, all the three of them are on the couch smoking weed and just smoking about talking about whatever. I'm sort of like the fourth part of that conversation, but I'm just behind the camera, and I'm sort of like if I hear something that I think could develop into something and into a one-liner or something funny, I'll say, hey, let's go in this direction. And then, mm-hmm. oh, can you repeat that line? But this time give me this at the end of that line.
Right, so
we're basically helping one another figure out the best way of delivering the material. And I think that that's really just like improv is what makes me the most excited, especially because I'm the editor. I'm the editor. And mm-hmm. editing is so monotonous and it puts me into a really bad state, but if I can at least
really bad. I've been a cutter. Been a cutter for 25 years. Did I know what you mean?
Oh, okay. So you know, it's really a lonesome place. So anyway, when you're there though, you want to be excited and you want to be entertained. So when I have like five takes and they're all slightly different because of the mm-hmm. improv, mm-hmm. that keeps me thinking and keeps me awake. It's not just about, oh, does the continuity work on this shot? No, it's about like, where is the best material? And it's actually like rewriting while you're in post-production, because mm-hmm. you're given a lot more to write with. You're given like, you know, five ingredients instead of the one ingredient being repeated five times. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So it's absolutely, absolutely. I love working with actors who improv and that whole storytelling process. Absolutely. It makes it much more fun and lively. It keeps you awake. Like you said, it does keep you awake, because I've edited movies that are like – the same, like five takes of the same exact lines being said, just with different infant, you know, like how the face looked or this and that. And that just becomes monotonous. But when you have five different takes and then trying to cut those, by the way, trying to cut those with other coverage when they're not the same, that's when it becomes even more fun.
That's the hard part.
Very
hard. But you know what? You figure it out. And thank God that audiences will accept like jump cuts these days. Mm-hmm. They'll accept jump cuts, and there's a certain style of filmmaking that leans towards the docu-style, which will allow you to like to get away with a lot of more stuff than you would in just traditional lockdown camera stuff. Even though I do have a lot of lockdown camera. I really do have a lot of lockdown camera in the new film. Mm-hmm. But I had a lot of lockdown camera. It's just you don't think about it, but I actually do have lockdown camera in Starlet and Tangerine. Mm-hmm. And these days you can play with you can actually use matting mm-hmm. and comping to help you, you know, fix problematic scenes, mm-hmm. you know, by splitting the screen in half and using the earlier part of the second take on the right side and using another part of another take on the left side, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, if you have a lockdown camera, you can do that.
Yes. And I've been doing a lot of that stuff. That opening scene of Tangerine is actually a lot more complicated than just a shot reverse shot. It's actually, there's a lot of that stuff going on in there.
That's awesome.
You just don't see it.
That's the point.
I had to play with the traffic. because the traffic's going in every which direction if I just, you know, but, mm-hmm. but on that corner, in order for it to work continuity wise, I had to do a lot of that cheating in post.
That's awesome. Now, can you tell me a little bit about your Sundance experience? Because I know a lot of people listening, it's that is the holy grail, that is the top of the mountain for a lot of filmmakers. Although I know, you know, the reality it isn't, but that is such right. a notch on the belt. Like, how was your experience going there? Because obviously this was the first time you were there. Sure, you had Jay and Mark's name on the movie, which got you a little bit of attention, but at the end of the day, if the movie is not good, it doesn't really matter. So before the first screening and after the first screening, I'd love to hear your experience, because I know I read that Steven Soderbergh, prior to Sex, Lies, and Videotape in 1989, he literally was sitting alone at that one diner that's on Main Street that everyone has yeah. office at, and nobody even knew who the hell he was. And then the second it was really – there was just just everybody. He was a rock star. He became a rock star all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's actually – I mean, my experience – listen, I'm neurotic. I'm crazy. So it's like the whole time it was actually not the best experience in the world in terms of, you know, I was just there's a lot of babysitting going on.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Because, you know, you're looking after your crew and your actors and you're hoping everybody is having a good time and not freezing. And, you know, there's a lot of that, just logistics of going through the week. I actually, you know, you don't want to party too hard either because you have business to do. So a lot of it was just about anticipation of who's going to buy the film and for how much. And then for me, looking back at that time, it is a little bit of a blur, but what I do remember, the most significant part of the whole week for me was being in the room with Magnolia, with Mark, with my agent, and mm-hmm. with Josh Braun from Submarine, which is a sales agent agency. Just listening to Magnolia give us their pitch about how they would release the film, hearing Mark and the others talk about what we would like. And that was really like, okay, good. I am learning something here. I've been in the industry for over 20 years, but this is fresh to me. I'm learning how a film is acquired, and how the relationship is formed between, even though I've done this before, this was the Sundance one. This was the Sundance experience of it. Yeah. Because, you know, I sold Starlet on a Vimeo link. It showed at South by Southwest, did all right there critically, but Music Box didn't even see it there. They saw it on a Vimeo link. Mm-hmm. So this was a very different experience, and that was the takeaway where I'm like, this is very interesting to see the way that Mark Duplass works, the way that things are negotiated. That was really great. And so the rest of the time was really just about, you know, doing all that press, which is you know, it's fine. It's fun. You're getting exposure, and
it opened up some doors for you. Obviously,
it did. It actually, you know, led to me being able to find financiers for the newest film, which is the first time I'm working, you know, above $1 million budget, and it's also just. It allowed me to, to work with a movie star, you know, like, you know, Willem Dafoe is an incredible actor.
Oh, geez, he's amazing. You know, tell us about your new project.
It's called The Florida Project. Mm-hmm. That's what it's literally called. It's not the working title. It's called The Florida Project. And
did you shoot it? I'm assuming you shot it.
I know some people didn't even know that until like the rap party. They're like, so what are you going to call this? And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's called The Florida Project.
Did you shoot in Florida?
Yes, we did.
Where did you shoot? Yeah. Where'd you shoot?
Okay. Well, here's the crazy and very sad part. Uh-huh. We started shooting less than a week after the shooting at Pulse, the club. We were shooting in Orlando and Kissimmee.
Yeah.
And so we had that going on that week we had the little kid who was unfortunately killed by the alligator at Disney.
Yeah,
you had that other shooting. I mean, it was a very strange summer there. It was a very, you know, and then they just got hit by the hurricane last week. So it's such a that area has not had a break.
This is why I left. I mean, it was a rough. A lot of stuff happens in Florida, unfortunately.
Yeah, Florida really is. I mean, looking back, it was like a trauma for us. I mean, it was a very traumatic experience. I mean, but we were shooting. We also put ourselves in that situation. We put ourselves in the dead, you know, in the middle of an incredibly hot summer in the middle of central Florida, right?
Oh, my God. You must have lost like 100 pounds.
Yeah. We're shooting 35 millimeter. We're using primarily kids because it's like a Little Rascals movie. Mm-hmm. So you have like kids, 35 millimeter, sun, you know, and then plus all the other craziness going on. It was we just like set ourselves up for just – an incredibly hard shoot. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I think we got something. I'm in post-production now, so we'll see. I mean, I know that the performances are incredible. I mean, I really am very happy with my cast.
Now, how did you work – like, and this is a, you know, director to director. How would you direct William Dafoe? Like, how do you do that? How is that conversation happening?
Well, he is – you know, most of the time – just letting him do what he does best, you know, just he brings his you know, masterful, you know, instincts to the table. So he, you know, 99% of the time we're on the same page where he understands the character, he understands the scene. Mm-hmm. And it's more about just tweaking. And when there was something that I thought we weren't on the same page about, it's simply a conversation. And the great thing about Willem is that he's such a nice guy. He's like the nicest guy in the whole world. So I was intimidated, but it wasn't that much intimidation. And plus on top of that, it was just such an incredible, as I said, an incredibly hard shoot that there wasn't a lot of time. It was like, we got to get this right now. So let's just figure it out. And we just all would figure it out and move on. He was just, you know, he just an incredibly nice guy who was very easy to work with and who wanted us to experiment, you know. Mm-hmm. I bet he almost wished we shot it on the iPhone so there was more experimentation. But, you know, we were shooting on 35. We're suddenly like, you're almost down to two setups an hour when you have, when you have an iPhone, which is 100 setups an hour, if you want it to be. So it's a very different way of making a film.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose 35, by the way?
Because, ultimately I feel it's a project by project. It's on a project by project basis for this film. I felt because of the subject matter, and because of the environment, that I really wanted that celluloid look. I mean, look at I love the way that Tangerine looks on the iPhone. I feel that there's no other way we could have made that movie for that budget. And even if we had a multi-millions to make Tangerine, I still, you know, feel as if the iPhone was the proper way of doing it, but that doesn't apply to Florida Project. I'm Florida Project. I needed a slicker look. I truly feel as if, you know, the organic nature of celluloid is so incredibly beautiful. And that, I wanted to capture that. I wanted to capture the Floridian colors, et cetera, et cetera. Plus on top of that, there is another thing that I think a lot of filmmakers aren't talking about, and we really should be talking about this stuff more like the way that Nolan does and Tarantino, is that we have to hold on to this medium. We're letting business tell us how to make our art. We're having the industry say, oh, it's easier and cheaper to shoot on digital, so therefore you guys do that. Well, that's horrible. I mean, we're filmmakers first and foremost. We should choose our canvas. You know what I mean? This is not, we shouldn't have it dictated upon us. And I think that, you know, we cannot lose celluloid. I mean, if we should have that choice to shoot on it if we want to, and if we have the money to do it. And I think that we have to fight to do that. And there are filmmakers out there like, you know, James Ponsold and Ty West, who are saying, look, I'm shooting on 35, you know, or I'm not making the movie. And that's how I'm starting to go, where it's like, there will be reasons for me to shoot digitally. But if I can shoot on 35, I'm going to, because ultimately the image is an incredible image that you really cannot, no matter what anyone says, you cannot, imitate with digital. Not yet. You can't.
Not really. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the reasons. And then also, there's that archival thing that nobody's talking about either, that, you know, even if you shoot digitally, I feel as if you should do a film out. Now you can say, well, where will I find the $50,000? I don't know. I'm trying to find $50,000 to do a film out on takeout, because I feel that takeout is a film that deserves it. And it would look the way we really wanted it to look if I was able to do a film out. But film out cost, you know, so much money. So,
right.
You know, it's this weird sort of, this is just a dilemma that we've always been having to face, that we're working with the most expensive art form.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Which, yes, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I know. Trust me, I know. I wish we could just grab a piece of paper and a pen and draw something, or write a song or play an instrument and you're good. But no, we've picked pretty much the most expensive form of artwork, maybe other than an architect.
Yeah, exactly.
So last two questions. I asked all my guests this same two questions. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in life or in the film business?
The longest to learn. Oh God, that's a hard one. One of the lessons that I, that's a hard one. One of the lessons that I learned early on, but I'm still having to always remind myself is just to do it, just to be proactive, and don't wait for anybody to tell you when or when not to do something.
I think that's the
lesson that even to this day, I have to remind myself that's how I, you know, I got to make my last couple of films, because I made those first three on my own. Mm-hmm. Even when people told me, oh, you should wait until, you know, you get a backer, or, you know, you should wait until whatever, until you're working. Yeah. And I didn't wait. And because I didn't wait, it's because, and that's why I'm, you know, able to finally make somewhat of a living in this industry. So I would say that's a lesson that you're always going to be people are going to try to pressure you out of it. So that's a lesson you constantly have to, you know, keep relearning and keep, you know, being on top of, is that, you know, you just really have to be your own motivator and really your own cheerleader.
No question about it. I couldn't agree with you more, my friend. I forgot. One of my guests said this, that, no, it was actually Robert Rodriguez. I was listening to an interview he did, or a lecture he did, and he says that karma, the universe conspires to help you once you become active. Thinking about it,
true.
And sitting down, you can't. There's no opportunity for the universe to give you anything. Like, it's not going to, like, you know, Mark Duplass is not going to knock on your door and go, here's the money, let's go to Sundance. It doesn't work that way. Like, you have to get that momentum going and just do. Whether it's good or bad, that's indifferent. Just do, because something good will come out of it.
Exactly.
And what are the three of your favorite films of all time, in no particular order?
Oh, gosh. This is funny, because I get asked that a lot, and it's always – the list always changes.
Sure.
So I realize that, like – it just happens to be in, you know, in October of 2016, I guess the films that mean the most to me right now are, I would say Lars von Trier's The Idiots. Mm-hmm. That really hasn't changed, actually, mm-hmm. for quite a long time. It's because, a good film, yeah. I consider it extremely – see, that's where – like when people say, well, wait a minute. You're talking so passionately about 35 millimeter, but that film is a standard definition video mm-hmm. film. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that's where I'm also at the same time always have to remind myself that – ultimately, it is not about, you know, the format. It's about the content. The that's story. Something mm-hmm. that – that's a lesson that probably I'll never learn. So touché, but anyway, yeah, so, yeah. So yes, there's that film. And then I would say March of the Wooden Soldiers, the Laurel and Hardy, you know, comedy back in the day.
Yeah.
Which is also – Babes in Toyland. I love mm-hmm. that film so much, and I mm-hmm. consider that comedy one of the, you know, it's hardly aged at all. It's mm-hmm. almost 100 years old. And oh my gosh, oh god, this is a hard. It is so hard. I can't believe. I would have to say Harold and Maude.
Oh yeah, that's been on the list on many of my guests. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to deny it. So yeah,
Harold and Maude is an awesome, awesome movie. Now where can people find you online?
I am I'm on Twitter mm-hmm. at let me see what my handle is. I think it's at Lil Film. It's L.
I'll put the link in the show notes, so don't worry about that. But you're on Twitter.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. Yeah, and I have just a one of those professional pages on Facebook if you wanna find me there. Okay. But most of my stuff that I get out there is through Twitter, and it's really just a lot of like it's pretty geeky. It's just me talking about like what Blu-rays I've watched recently.
Yeah.
But
how we met. We met on Twitter as well. So
it
works.
There you go.
It does work. You know, I'm still never am shocked at who I can connect with on Twitter. It's fascinating. I've gotten so many amazing guests and talked to people and just connected with people that it was Twitter. It's just through a tweet.
I actually think that social networking and just the internet in general is such an amazing new way of working. Also, if you can figure out a way of you know, using it, exploiting it to as much as you can in film. You know, I cast my new film. Well, I did a lot of casting with Tangerine through things like, you know, Instagram and mm-hmm. and Twitter and this and that. But the new film, Florida Project, has one of the leads who I cast through Instagram.
That's insane.
Yeah,
but it's true. And it's great.
Yeah, she never acted before, but I knew her personality was incredibly interesting, and she had the right look, and she was funny. And next thing you know, she's holding her own against Willem Dafoe.
And that's the way the world works, my friend. That's the way the world works. Yeah, Sean, man, thank you so much for taking out your time of your busy schedule. I know you're in post right now, so thank you for jumping on the show and dropping some knowledge bombs, man.
Oh, thank you so much.
And there you have it, guys. I told you, Sean was awesome. I was so happy to have him on the show because I was dying to ask him a whole bunch of questions about how he shot this thing. And I think we got into it pretty deep into how he made Tangerine. I'm excited about his new movie as well. And if you want any of the show notes, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/111. And in there, you'll also have a complete explanation of all the gear he used, iPhone filmmaking stuff, and all sorts of cool stuff. So definitely check out the show notes on that one at indiefilmhustle.com/111. Don't forget to head over to freefilmmakingpodcast.com and leave us an honest review of the show. It really, really helps us out a lot, guys. I know you're busy. I know you're right now. But right now, listen, if you're on a commute right now, you're in a train somewhere, or you're sitting around waiting, listening to this at a coffee shop, just take a second. Go over to your iTunes. Leave us a review. Leave us a good review. It really helps me out a lot, man. I really, really, really appreciate it. And don't forget to head over to freefilmbook.com. That's freefilmbook.com, and download your free filmmaking audiobook from Audible. And that helps support the show
and keeps us going, my friend. So thank you again so much. I've got a lot of cool stuff coming up for the holidays. Got some new stuff I'm cooking up. And I'll give you updates on This Is Meg as I get them. So, oh, and by the way, I'm going to be heading over to AFM next week. I'm going to be there on Monday. And I'm going to be checking things out over at AFM. I've never been to AFM, so I'm really curious about AFM and see what all the hoopla is about. So I'm going to be checking that out. And then I am going to also be at Sundance this year, guys. I'm going to make that announcement now. I am planning to be at Sundance, regardless if Meg gets into Sundance or Slam Dance this year. I am going to be heading over there, and I'm going to be doing some live podcasting. I'm going to be doing some pictures, videos, streaming, the whole ball of wax while I'm there. So keep an eye out for all of that stuff, and you'll be able to see the Sundance experience through the Indie Film Hustle lens, which is what I hopefully will be with Meg in one way, shape, or form. That would be awesome. But either way, I'm going to go over there, and I haven't been there in close to a decade. So I can't wait to go there and share that all that stuff with you guys as well. So thanks again, guys, and keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.